Well, good afternoon, Juno, on a rainy afternoon. It's a couple of seconds before 3 o'clock. Pat Moore, your host today. I'll be hosting Juno Afternoon for the next hour. Please stay with me as folks come in to tell us about the Tot Rave coming up for the second time at DIPAC coming on Saturday. We'll have Randall Tetlici here as our guest. He's a special guest at the University of Alaska Southeast for this week, bringing the First Nations perspective to UAS. Our sustainability segment today will deal with a group of children who are doing composting at Montessori Adolescent Program, and we'll talk with them about their composting operation and also bring in Darren Snyder to tell how he organized that with them. Gastineau Elementary School Principal Brenda Edwards will join us as well. The weather looks like rain, which you're looking at out your window right now. It'll turn to snow probably this evening. We'll get a little snow tomorrow, and then it'll go back to rain.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Voter rights advocates are prepared for a long day at the polls. In Arizona, Native vote advocates say they'll be watching for any challengers that may try to intimidate voters. Tristan Autone reports.
With a Senate race, 3 House races, a president to pick, nearly 24 tribes, and just under 5% of Arizona's voting population eligible Native voters, there will be a lot up for grabs at polls in the Grand Canyon state, including the right to vote. Native Vote Arizona says they're prepared for difficulties and complexities at the polls that they've seen in past elections, like voter registration and address issues, voting machines going out of commission, and problems with a unique and stringent voter ID law. But this election, Native Vote volunteer Ed Hermes says poll watchers will also be on guard for vote challengers.
There are organizations like True the Vote or Verify the Vote that we haven't had in past years, organizations that are committed to trying to challenge people's right to vote inside the polls. And that's something we've been training all of our volunteers on being vigilant about, being ready for, in case there's folks who are actively trying to disenfranchise Native voters from voting by challenging their right to vote.
Hermes says vote challenging hasn't happened in decades, although the law allowing vote challengers has been on Arizona's books since the mid-20th century.
We haven't seen it in a long time. These laws are still on the books. The ability to challenge is still on the books. And this is kind of a new revival for some organizations trying to do some of these pre-civil rights era type efforts to disenfranchise voters.
Native voters in Arizona and across the country can call Native Vote volunteers if they encounter any problems at the polls. In nearly 20 states, Native voters are expected to have impacts on House, Senate, and other local races, including Montana, New Mexico, Wisconsin, Colorado, and Arizona, to name a few. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
The new Grand Chief of the Innu Nation says his recent victory was a win for sobriety. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the troubled Canadian reserve in Labrador was surrounded by controversy over alcohol and gasoline sniffing during the election.
The reserve of Davis Inlet once made international headlines after images of children sniffing gasoline were seen worldwide. The Canadian government relocated the 600 residents to a modern housing reserve at Nattawashish in 2002. But once again, the community is the center of controversy. During the recent election, Innu people were voting for new leaders. The campaign was marred by accusations that some candidates provided alcohol to buy votes. And then there was this video shown on national television of teens and children sniffing gasoline when they said they weren't given alcohol.
Right away, see you around town. But they don't know how to share, though.
They don't want to give us some whiskey.
Police say there were about 40 children sniffing gas at different times. They say the gas and solvent sniffing is bad enough, but when people start operating vehicles and firearms are factored in, it ups the ante and someone is bound to get hurt sooner or later. The new Grand Chief, Prote Poker, says he never used drugs or alcohol to buy votes. That's not the way Innu elections are run. And he sees his victory as a positive sign.
The positive thing that happened in this election, I think the people, we were elected because we campaigned on for sober leadership and without using any alcohol and drugs. I think that's a big change in the result of the elections.
A former chief of the reserve says it's heartbreaking to see so many children leave the province for addiction treatment. Katie Rich says the community has lost its focus. Most of those living in the remote enclave are under 18, and even though Nattawasheesh is officially a dry community, liquor is still smuggled in. She says there are also few organized activities for young people, and their needs are being forgotten. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
On this day in 2011, an inauguration ceremony was held for Bill John Baker. After a long election process, which included a recount and second election, Baker became principal chief of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My first two guests are here to tell us about an event which is coming around for the second time ever. This is the second annual Tot Rave. A rave is kind of a wild dance. This is an interesting concept. You're holding it over at DIPAC, right?
Yeah.
My guests, by the way, are Samia Seville and Carol McKenzie. Hi, Carol. Hi, Samia.
Hi.
So what's happening?
Well, we thought the name Tot Rave would get people's attention. It's basically a dance for kids. You know, kids love to dance, and it's we really wanted to host a fun community event that's oriented towards families with young children. So this is a dance that's really kind of focused on the younger crowd, kids ages 6 and under, and their families, and just have a good time and dance. So we scheduled it at very kid-friendly time, 4:30 to 7:30, and usually by 7:30 young kids are pretty much ready to get in their pajamas and go to bed. So, and this will also give the parents a chance to socialize and get together as well.
So, Carol, what was your role in putting this event together?
Well, right now I'm the current president of the Gold Creek Child Care Development Board, and Sammy is our former president and current board member also. So we worked with DIPAC in getting the facility, and we'll have food there because it is over the dinner time. So we've been organizing some food, and we have a special person coming in as a DJ, White Chocolate. Mm. And we promise it will be kid-friendly music to dance to and get out. And then we also have a couple presentations, one by
Complete Warrior
for martial arts. And again, that's kid friendly. We'll have some young kids showing the younger kids what is possible to do. And then Janice Hurley will be there, and she will lead the kids in some dances to get them out moving. So again, as Sammy has said, we just hope it's a fun-filled night for all the kids of all ages.
I notice on the program you also are saying that you're going to have a silent auction. Is this aimed at the kids?
Yeah, there's some really great items both for kids and for adults in the silent auction. And so this is all a fundraiser event, and we raise funds not only to help offset tuition costs for families who need to work and need child care, but also we try to host community events such as this one, as well as in the last year we had a brown bag lunch series that was open to the public to educate parents about early childhood development and maybe different phases that your child may be going through, that type of thing. And we've partnered in the past with the Canvas to host Art for Tots, which was a fun event on Saturdays during the fall and winter to expose really young children to different art techniques. And so we like to host these fundraising events not only to have fun but also to try to provide a little bit of something back to the community for kids and their parents.
So, Sammy, you mentioned two things that you did last year. Do you have events coming up this year, this fall and winter?
We have tentatively planned another brown bag lunch series, but we tend to schedule those in the January to March range. And so at this moment in time, this is the big event this Saturday.
So when you do the brown bag lunch, where do you hold those?
We've hosted them in a variety of locations at the downtown library. We had a couple of those lunch events, and then I think we had a couple more in the federal building itself, and those are still open to the public. Just you have to go through security, of course, to get to the conference room. But
well, I think you've nailed something about, I want to say about Juneau, because I don't remember this kind of thing happening in some of the other places I've lived, but every arts event that I have been to that involved live music, I've looked around at some time near the middle of the second half or the first part of the second half of the show, and there are kids up in the aisles, and they're always dancing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an amazing, and parents seem to be totally free about allowing their children to do this, which is just fine. I mean, it lets them enjoy the music and takes the heat off the parents a little bit, and they're not hurting a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that this is real common here in Juneau, and I don't remember seeing that happen in other places that I've lived.
Yeah, yeah.
So
It'll be fun, and we really also realized when we put this together last year as well as this year that there's a whole lot of kid music out there, and parents with young children know what it's like to listen to the same Barney tape over and over again. So that's why we kind of build it as a Rafi free event. So we're having parent friendly kid music, kid friendly adult music. I don't know how you want to put it, but music that can be enjoyed by everybody.
I had to live through a situation where I had two children who liked Raffi and a wife who liked Raffi too, so it was hard to get away from it. Anyway, so the music starts at 4:30. There will be some dance lessons, complete warrior martial arts. This is all held at DIPAC. Is there a charge for this thing?
It's $5 for people ages 3 and up, mm-hmm. and kids ages 2 and under are free. And folks get a glow bracelet when they enter. Every parent will be required to sign in on a sheet and with a corresponding number to their child, so we make sure that everybody's accounted for. We do not allow adults without the accompaniment of a child, so that's important to note there, too. And then there's a no-host snack bar as well with kid-friendly food. We're going to have, you know, small size sandwiches and apple slices and milk and that type of thing, finger food that kids will enjoy and adults as well.
Oh, I think you got the focus in the right place. So it's called the Tot Rave, 4:30 to 7:30 at DIPAC on Saturday, November 10th, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Samia Seville and Carol McKenzie, thank you so much for alerting our audience to this great possibility.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. During this season, a small diving duck returns from the boreal forests of the north to winter in our waters. It's called the bufflehead. This bird comes with many nicknames, such as little black and white duck, bumblebee duck, buffalo-headed duck, butterball, and spirit duck. Taken together, these names well describe the bufflehead. The name Little Black and White Duck highlights the bird's striking plumage. Its black head, which shimmers with iridescent green and purple, sports a large patch of pure white. Bumblebee duck implies that this is the smallest diving duck in North America, and its nickname further suggests its fast, buzzy flight. The common name bufflehead is a corruption of the bird's original name, buffalo head, a reference to the disproportionately large domed head of the male. Hunters use the name butterball to describe how fat the bird can be when prepared for eating. Finally, Spirit Duck came from the bubblehead's apparently supernatural ability to dive to safety as soon as it saw the flash of the old muzzle loaders. You can get email with photos of birds to be featured in the week ahead. Sign up for the weekly preview at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Minutes after 3 here at KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next two guests are doing a series of things this, I think, this entire week up on campus. Randall Titlici is here. He's from the, he actually is at the university in Whitehorse, and is doing a number of things that involve storytelling in the classroom. And with him is Colleen James from the University of Alaska Southeast. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what are you doing while you're here?
Well, I'm here. I'm enjoying the view, enjoying Juno, and thinking about the past teachings that I got from some of the elders from Juno, and going to the classes to do talks and do some teachings.
So have you been in classrooms so far?
Yeah, I've been in... Since the last couple of days, I've been in classroom, yeah.
What would you think, how do you think the reception has been?
The reception is great. The students respond. They want to learn. They're eager. They're keen. And the energy is there to do the work.
UAS has a kind of a resurgence in Tlingit learning going on. We've just started a Tlingit language program fairly recently, and we've added faculty members. I've had several of them here on the show, and we've talked about the kind of rising interest in bringing Tlingit language back to life and making it a much stronger part of our culture. Are you experiencing anything similar to that in Whitehorse?
Yeah, in Whitehorse and in the communities, we're experiencing that kind of a same thing. And we have a language program at our college, and we have 6 languages in the Yukon, and we teach all the 6 languages in the Yukon. So that's going pretty good.
Now, you grew up in the Northwest Territories.
I grew up in the Yukon Territory.
Oh, in the Yukon Territory.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's see. So, I can't remember what the name of the little town was. Old Crow, yeah. And you were part of the I don't know how to say this, Wuntut-Gwich'in tribe, is that?
Wuntut-Gwich'in tribe.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
That's people of the lakes that were northern Yukon, and there's about 250 people there. All the young people... are leaving because of education and work.
And you've left and moved down to Whitehorse? And
I left, too, because my son was going to go to high school, so I didn't want him to go by himself. So me and my wife moved to Whitehorse, too. So, and now I work at Yukon College. So as an elder and resident and student support.
And Colleen, here he's the elder in residence for 1 week, is that right?
Right.
In our program? Okay.
Yep, we do have an elder in residence program, and our elder currently is David Katzik. And so we're hoping to bring both elders together at our Native Moral Student Center.
Now, as part of this week's-long series of events, there are 2 films, I think. There's one tonight, and then there's one on Saturday. Is that right?
There's a film tonight, and that one is on the ice, and the discussion after the film will be led by one of our faculty, Lance Twitchell. And then the other film is, I believe it's Thursday.
Okay.
And that one is Being Caribou, and that will highlight our elder Randall Titlici and his experience with the young research and filmographer. So
Kirsten Hewer is part of the staff at UAS, right?
No. That's visiting.
Oh, okay.
Visiting.
He's a visiting profound. Okay, anyway. And so this film, Being Caribou, was the story of Karsten and a young lady named Allison who followed the caribou herd for an entire season.
Yeah, they followed the caribou for 5 months.
Yeah. And were you part of that film? Were you in there? Or
in part of it and bits and pieces of it, but not the whole thing. Yeah.
There's a quotation that's attributed to you. I found it on a website where you say that the caribou understand that the elders told us that there would be bad days ahead and that the caribou understand this, and the reason they're gone, they're leaving, is because of their spirit. What were you referring to?
I was referring to the spirit of their life and what's happening today in terms of global warming and climate change, and they have to adapt to the change and to the growth, the change in the environment, and they are changing, and they're changing their migration routes. They're mating in different seasons, so, and they're calving later. So these are the things that I was referring to when I was talking about the spirit of the caribou.
Do you see this as a bad thing?
Well, the climate change and global warming, it's happening. It has to happen. So there will be some good things that are going to come out of it at the end of these changes. So.
That's an interesting perspective. I think that we tend, a lot of times the news media leads us into a kind of a thinking that the only possible outcome of global warming would be, you know, destruction. But it sounds like you're saying that what comes out of it is more adaptation.
Yeah, it's according to the elders and some of the stories and some of the prophecies that this is going to happen, and There will be some, you know, damaging stuff that happened that has to take place before the, at the end of the change. And once the change is done, then the earth will go back into balance.
It's an unusually hopeful philosophy, I guess.
Yeah, it's you gotta have faith and you gotta believe and you gotta live according to the climate change and global warming. You gotta adapt. You gotta adapt the way you think, the way you see, the way you listen, the way you talk about it. So when you do that, then you're gonna behave in that manner, and you will move forward in life.
Huh. And you learn this from stories.
I learn this from stories and from the elders in the 50s and 60s, they were talking about what's happening today.
Huh. And were you when you started hearing the elders saying these things, did you at first take them seriously? Did it take you a while to, I don't know if I'm asking the right question. How did you feel about what you were hearing them say in the 50s and 60s?
Oh, I believe what they're saying because they were my professors, my teachers, and my elders, so everything they talk about, you know, I believe in what they're saying. You know, one of the things as First Nation, as a Native person, is sometimes you got to believe what you can't see. Yeah. To develop our mind. So.
This afternoon, we had a luncheon on campus, and one of the messages along the same vein of thought that Randall had shared with our students was that this global change, this climate change, is what it should be doing is having everyone look at themselves and how they're connected to the land. And when he mentioned adapting, I think what we were hearing out at the university was not to continue what we're doing, you know, with blowing up our mountains to get, you know, whatever gold or treasures that the earth has, but to stop and acknowledge that we need to get back in touch with our roots and our are with Earth. And so our students responded well to that. In fact, I think because we're Generation X, they're all about looking at what problems are happening around us and trying to figure out how to be part of the solution. And his lecture earlier today spoke to how we're responsible for what's happening, and we have the power to correct it and heal the earth and heal ourselves. So
when you talk to a group of students and you express a thought like that, how do you know how they're responding to you?
When I look at them, I see their interests, I see their enthusiasm, because it's a new knowledge they're learning, and they're eager to learn about these new knowledge. So far, they had lots of scientific knowledge, but they never had any traditional knowledge or traditional teachings or training. So that's what I focus on when I go into classes. And it doesn't matter what race they come from or what nationality they come from. They're eager to learn, and they want to learn because they're our future. And when you look at global warming and climate change, they're my biggest concern.
I've read that many things that we understand about the Earth are expressed in our language, and that one of the reasons that we need to bring these languages back to life is because they have a stronger feeling for the natural state of things than does English or some of the other Western languages. Is that, as a speaker of two or more languages, is that your experience?
Yeah, that's my experience. It's my belief that the language is sacred, the language is holy, the language is part of us, it's part of our life, the language is part of the environment. The language is part of the whole universe, and when you speak your language, you get that, you feel proud to be who you are. The language gives you something. It gives you satisfaction. It gives your life a meaning, a purpose, and so that's how come language is very important to the people. And you know, the land, the ocean, everything is part of our language, and it's a spiritual language also. Yeah.
I was very surprised to read a while back that there are expressions in Yupik Eskimo. The verbs have the capability of telling whether something is moving and how fast it is moving in a single word. So that if something large is moving at a certain speed, this is expressed so quickly that it can be done just in one single word. Are there examples like that in your language? Colleen is nodding her head. Can you give me a...
I'm actually going to let Randall respond to this, but it's like you were at our presentation earlier. You're asking all these great questions. Sorry, go ahead, Randall.
Yeah, so we have a lot of words that express things fast, you know, really quickly without, you know, sometimes there's only one word, but it's expressing a lot of things, and it means a lot of things, so we have a lot of words like that.
Can you give me an example?
That's right. Yeah.
Which means?
That means it's blowing, and it's snowing, and it's bad weather outside.
Huh. And all of that you communicated with a single word.
A single word.
Yeah. Which I don't know if that has the same meaning as yuck, but... Okay, well, we have an opportunity, I guess, to hear you talk. Colleen, help me with this. When will Randall be speaking?
Well, we actually, he'll be visiting our campus, and actually he's been invited into classrooms throughout the school district. And so folks, lucky students, will have the opportunity of meeting with him there. But the main event that the community is welcome to come to is our evening at Egan that we hold every Friday at our campus.
This coming Friday.
Randall will be talking about our connection to Earth and and what's happening today, very much like the questions that you were posing to Randall today, will be, he'll be presenting on that on Friday.
Well, I may have to come and see how my questions get answered. Okay, so Friday night, 7 o'clock, is that right?
Yeah, in the Egan Library.
And you're in the Egan Library, the larger area, so more people can attend. Okay, good. And Randall, we thank you so much for traveling over here from Whitehorse to be our temporary elder in residence for a week. It sounds like you're doing a great job in and out of the classrooms.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Goodness cheese.
Goodness cheese.
Good job.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 6th of November, 2012. Today is Election Day. Millions of people across the country going to the polls, elect legislators and judges and sheriffs and school board members and, of course, the president. The first federal election under our Constitution held in 1788. Only 11% of eligible voters voted. To be eligible, you had to be a white male property owner, but different states had trouble defining what a property owner was, so there was confusion. And in order to vote in that first election, 1788, voters had to travel many miles to the nearest polling place, which was often a tavern, the candidate standing outside, and in many precincts there were no ballots. People just announced their votes to the sheriff in a loud, clear voice, and then they stood by the candidate they had voted for, who usually offered them something to drink. It wasn't until 1820 that American voters in every state could vote in the presidential election. Before that, many states just let the legislature choose the presidential electors who would cast their votes for president. And even after the popular election had come in, different states held Election Day on different dates. The first uniform Election Day did not take place until 1845 on November the 4th. For the first 50 years of elections in this country, only about 15% of the adult population was eligible to vote. Poor people were not, nor were women. And many African Americans were prevented from voting throughout the South until the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It was Mark Twain who said, "If there's any valuable difference between a monarchist and an American, it lies in the theory that the American can decide for himself what is patriotic and what isn't. I claim that difference. I am the only person in the 60 millions that is privileged to dictate my patriotism." Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, entitled "The Fox." It was an ordinary morning, November, thin light, and we paused over our pancakes to watch something red move outside. Our house is on an untamed patch of land, and across the lagoon another house surrounded by trees. On the banks of their shore, facing us, a fox. We thought he might be a dog at first, for he trotted and sniffed like a dog. But when he turned to us, we knew he was nobody's pet. His face was arranged like a child's face, playful, dainty, and his eyes were liquid and wild. He stood for a while, looking out, as if he could see us in our pajamas, then found a patch of sand beneath a tree, and turned himself into a circle of fur, his head tucked into his tail. It was awful to watch him sleep, exposed, tiny, his eyes closed. How can any animal be safe enough to rest? But while I washed our dishes, he woke again, yawned, and ran away to the places only foxes know. My God, I was tired of being a person. Even now, his tail gestures to me across the disapproving lagoon. A poem entitled The Fox by Faith Sheeran from Moving the Piano, published by Stephen F. Austin State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites. Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. The music tells us that it's time once again to turn our attention to the question of sustainability for Juneau. Through the month of October, we've been looking at ways to reduce the amount of waste that goes into our landfill. We've looked at various recycling programs. And over the last three programs, we've talked to gardeners and Cooperative Extension agent Darren Snyder about composting food, lawn, and garden waste to keep down the amount of these substances going into Juneau's landfill. After looking at a number of outdoor composting operations, I visited the Montessori Borealis Adolescent Program, which is housed in the Marie Drake School. I met Jillian Smith, Katie Price, and Amy McDonald, three Montessori students who are participating in a program to compost the leftovers and scraps from the Montessori students' lunches. What we're looking at here in the middle of the table is a little white bucket kind of thing with holes in the lid. What is that?
It's the compost bucket.
Okay, and how does this work?
Well, if you take the lid off, you'll see that there's a little plastic bag here. And if you have compost, like leftover from lunch, you can put it in the bag, and then at the end of the day, we'll take it and put it in the compost bin.
Okay. And now, who puts the stuff in here?
Anybody who has fruit and vegetable waste, anything that can be composted.
Okay. Are there things that can't be composted?
Yes, things like meat and fish and oils can't be composted.
Why not?
Well, they attract mice and rats, and they stink.
Okay, and I noticed when you opened it up, now this is all just put in today, right? After, like in the afternoon or like that, when you've finished, everybody's put their stuff in, does this thing smell bad?
No, it has a carbon fiber.
Okay.
Filter on in the lid. So
she's
that
pointing to a black surface substance that's inside the lid. The container's made out of ceramic. It's white ceramic, and then inside is this black thing, which is a carbon filter.
Yeah, and it traps the odor so that it doesn't smell.
Okay. Where'd you get this?
I'm not sure, actually.
I think one of our teachers ordered it for us last year.
Okay. Now, you said that at the end of the day, you take this down to the compost to another area. Can we go down there? Montessori class keeps their composting bin in a storage area behind the snack bar in Marie Drake School's gymnasium. Debbie Chalmers, instructor at the Montessori School, opened up the storeroom. She showed me the can of worms composter. It's a stack of cylinders that contains the materials that are being composted. I asked her if housing the operation in a school storeroom had caused any problems.
So far, it's been nice and clean. And that's what the kids will be learning about, what is most appropriate to put inside an indoor composting tub. You know, it's a little different than doing it outside and tossing it, physically tossing it. It's new for all of us. Thank you.
Juneau Cooperative Extension Agent Darren Snyder helped the students at Montessori set up their composting project. When I visited Darren in his office, he showed me a compost unit identical to the one that the Montessori students use. It's in a small storage area next door to Darren's office. As we stood in front of the black cylinders, he explained his role in helping start projects like this. You helped the Montessori class get started with one of these.
So I am a resource for the community and throughout Southeast to help folks with gardening and composting and vermiculture needs. And so I'm happy to take questions as people have them and to try and help them out. This is called a can of worms. I should say that each one of these commercial systems uses a tray method. And so what these trays are individual areas where you add the material that the worms are going to eat, you add the worms, and then you put your shredded paper on top. And then the worms will work on that and work on that. And then as you get more material, you put another layer of these trays on top of that, and then you add your additional material. So what this allows for the worms to do is to consume the rotting material where they are, and then they'll work their way up to the next level as they go. So the bottom tray becomes finished vermicompost at the end there. And as you'll see here, the bottom tray is getting mostly finished here, where we have the next tray up, which is more the raw materials still.
This one looks like the other. Yeah. Newspaper on top of some vegetable matter that we can clearly identify.
It's actually quite warm.
Yeah.
Interesting. And as you'll notice, the worms don't really consume the eggshells much. And so that's fine. If you're going to be putting this into your garden or any plant environment, then that's just added calcium and helps to neutralize the acidity of the soil anyway. So that's a good additive to have.
We've looked at composting in some detail over these last four programs because it seems to be the most accessible way for us to reduce the amount of waste going into Juneau's landfill each day. In our first program on composting, Pat Harris told us about how she has put together multiple composting bins at the community gardens, which she uses to generate new soil full of nutrients from the stalks and stems as she harvests her garden, and she puts that nutrient-rich soil back into her own garden plots. Suzanne and Sandy Williams showed us their three-bin cold composter. They operate it with minimal labor over in their backyard garden on Douglas. The Williamses also told us about the composting operation which is run by the Hoonah Landfill. According to them, customers who bring three bags of compostable garbage to the landfill can take home one bag of composted soil from the large-scale operation which the Hoonah Landfill runs. Now, there may be hope for such a large-scale operation here in Juneau. Once again, here's Cooperative Extension Agent Darren Snyder.
We actually have master gardeners through the Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program who have started up other vermiculture projects throughout the community. And it's a good way of taking care of what would be a waste product and turning it into a resource for ourselves. And in fact, I think that we are primed as a community to maybe expand a little bit with these efforts. And when we think about institutions such as our schools and other cafeterias where they have large amounts of organic plant waste and cafeteria waste, that we could actually create large-scale vermiculture composting systems that can turn out to save on waste that is otherwise going to be sent to the landfill, and also can produce a very a valuable product. The vermicompost is actually sold. I'm not sure what the current prices are, but somebody could actually sell this as a product. It could be an excellent student project, if not other people in the community.
We began looking at sustainability on Juno Afternoon back in September when we took our microphone over to the Jack for the final farmers market of the season and interviewed a number of people about how they saw the issues of sustainability for Juno. We'll be continuing this series throughout the month of November and into December. Each of these short programs will focus on a different aspect of Juno's journey towards self-reliance. Please join us next Tuesday at 3:30 here on Juno Afternoon as we begin looking at how Juno can become more self-reliant in the area of energy.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering coffee break service for the office, delivering fresh roasted coffees, brewing equipment, and beverage supplies to offices and businesses around Southeast. Information at heritagecoffee.com.
13 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. My next guest is Brenda Edwards, and Brenda has made the transition. She's moved from the classroom to being the principal of Gaston Elementary School. Welcome, Brenda.
Hello.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you how it feels to be out of the classroom behind the principal's desk and doing a different thing.
It is very exciting. Every day is different, just like with teaching. You know, you kind of make a plan for what the day is going to entail, but sometimes those plans don't work out and you have to, you know, fly by the seat of your pants a lot of the time. It's going really, really well. I'm really enjoying it. It's different, though. You're spending more time with adults, less time with kids, so I just have to make a point to get into classrooms and remind myself that that's why we all are doing what we're doing, is for our kids, for the students.
Now, you got a huge challenge right at the beginning of the year when you showed up for the first day of school and found out that basically your school was still under construction. So how have you adapted to that, and where is it standing at this point?
That was the flying on the seat of our pants. You know, we had to do that for quite a while, and from what I understand, the teachers had to go through that last year also, but this year a little bit different because it's a different part of the school. You know, we made plans, and sometimes those plans didn't work out. So we were, I have to give a lot of kudos and thanks to the staff and to the Gaston community and all of our parents for just being extremely supportive and very flexible and just, you know, trying to really understand that, you know, we're all doing the best that we could, but there were a lot of things that were out of our control. And I thought we handled ourselves very gracefully, and I'm proud of the work that we did.
So are you done with it now? Is the construction finished?
It's not finished. We have access to the entire school except for the front entrance. They were actually out pouring concrete today, which was nice to see. I'm not exactly sure the finish date for that, but there's also a big long list, punch list of things that need to be completed on the inside. But we do have access to the entire school on the inside, which is tremendous and you know, helps a lot.
Now, you mentioned the Gastineau community, and I think you're talking about your students and the teachers as a kind of a community that grows up around the school. As principal, your approach to that has to be very different than it probably was when you were teaching in the classroom. Is that? Do you find that?
Yeah, a lot of the same though, as far as teaching, where you know you're
keeping the big picture in mind and ways to enhance the students' experience at school and their understanding of who they are and where they come from. The Gastineau community, including the local businesses and all of the people that live in Gastineau that aren't necessarily affiliated with the school, just make it such a special place. And it really is a community school. People are very proud to be Gastineau students or former Gastineau students. And, my own son goes to Gastineau. We live on Douglas. So, it feels good to be part of be working in the community that we live in.
Douglas and downtown Juneau have real identities as communities. It's really interesting sometimes when you go out to Douglas and you see people, particularly in the summer, walking around and there's a very much wave to your neighbor and stop for a while and talk and say howdy. So it's a real interesting difference in community than I live in the valley, and it's not quite that way. We have small areas, like we live on a cul-de-sac, and we know all of our neighbors, and we all greet each other and like that. But we don't. There's no larger sense of that, and I sense that whenever I go to Douglas.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely, I've gotten the sense and, some evidence of parents looking out for other kids and, bigger kids looking out for younger kids because, everyone lives so close to the school, and it really is a big part of the community, the school is. So it's nice that we have this beautiful new school that, we can be really proud of and, be able to invite people to come in and participate in school activities with us.
Sometimes I think that bridge is a lot longer than...
Well, especially in the winter.
Yeah. I guess if you walk it every day, it's quite an experience anyway. So did you find... You were an outstanding teacher. You
Thank
won
you.
Awards all over the school district. You started up a bunch of Tlingit language programs, and you were really like the spark behind a whole bunch of those. And so now your focus is on one school. Your duties are administrative rather than teaching. Is there... there's a thing called the Peter Principle, which says that you get real good at something and then you get promoted into an area where you're not so good. Have you found that you were able to transfer the skills across into the new job?
I think so. I think it takes it's nice having that strong teaching background to understand where our students are and how I can affect taking those ideas and affect a larger amount of students. I've always really valued parent involvement and participation in the community, so it's really fulfilling for me to be able to take that idea to a whole school level and to see all the wonderful things that teachers are doing individually, but be able to take that step back and see how it's affecting our whole school community. And that's where I keep going back to that sense of Gastineau community, because it really is, and it's very apparent and very strong in our school.
What do we have to look forward to through the rest of the year at Gastineau?
We are, like I said, we're cruising now. Now that we have the school,
now that you have a facility,
we have the entire school. I really feel like, at least for myself, I've got my legs under me. I don't feel like I'm treading water anymore, and I'm really excited. We've got some really good things in the works. We're focusing a lot on student achievement and student data and what we can do as a school to improve our achievement. And it really comes down to, really focusing on the students and how we can better serve them and prepare them for life and for middle school and high school and graduation.
I guess my last question is, what kinds of problems are you working on right now that you expect you're going to be working on throughout the year?
I don't necessarily know if we have any problems, but some of the things that we're definitely working on is just getting this construction wrapped up. We don't have the presence of the construction workers like we've had so far, but it will be really nice to, have them, or have it all just done so we can, really just start moving forward. And it's going to make a big difference to have the front entrance. It's from what I see in the plans, it's going to be beautiful, and it's going to be really welcoming. So, you know, just getting the construction done and being able to focus just on our students and our teaching instead of having to worry about the day-to-day problems that or issues that we've had with the construction.
Brenda Edwards, principal at Gastineau Elementary School, part of the Gastineau community. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
in
you.
And bringing us up to date on what's happening over there.
Thank you.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
I'm Halina Aksak, and I'm a single mom trying to finish school to support for my son.
Halina lives in Wales, a village of about 150 people on the tip of the Seward Peninsula. Her son, Tristan Thomas, isn't quite a year old. A little before he was born, Halina dropped out of high school, but then she decided it was important to go back. She says she wants to give her son as many opportunities and as good of a life as she can. Halina's learned a lot on her journey through parenthood so far.
It doesn't take just two parents to raise one child. It takes a whole village. Don't let anybody put you down. Don't listen to anybody who tells you you can't do this or you're not going to be that. Just ignore them and pursue your dreams.
Halina's dreams go beyond being a good mom and a high school grad. She has an idea for starting a small business, an idea that if it worked, could help her and other parents in Wales, as well as put people there to work.
I wanted to start somewhat of a kid care during the day because people around here, no matter how small it is, they need it.
Roxy Quick is the principal at the Wales Kangikmute School.
Of course, we have lots of nice kids, but there's something special about her that goes over and above what is expected of any student. She's got a very positive, caring spirit. It's kind of a gift of hers, I think, that she just was born with.
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Association of Alaska School Boards, Initiative for Community Engagement.
Music by the Jazz Arts Trio, Night Train, of course, a wonderful wonderful song. Used to be a theme song of a jazz show I did years ago on the radio. Anyway, on Wednesday, Andy Klein will be in to host the program, and he'll be talking about the Trail Mix Dinner and Auction, Hospice Remembrance Gathering, Wildlife Wednesday, and Queen for a Day, and the future of wild Pacific salmon. So tune in for Andy tomorrow. We are KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We're also broadcasting on a set of translators throughout the area in the Valley and Auk Bay. You get our signal on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269AO at 101.7. We're on 88.1 megahertz in Gustavus on K201 AM. Huna hears us on 91.9 on K220BT, and in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210 AS at 89.9. You can also hear us on GCI Cable Juneau, digital channel 871, and we can be heard on 872 for KRNN, and KXLL is on 873.